the bodies hit the floor. Let the bodies hit the floor. Let the bodies hit the floor. Let the bodies hit the floor.
North South Connection Podcast Network. My goodness. Welcome to episode 34 of The Year That Was, where I am ranking the greatest years in WWF pay-per-view history after an arduous 3 years of watching. Christ, by the time I finish this list, I'm going to have to go back and add 2021 back into the mix, which I've been kind of watching, but not really. But here, look, here we are. With the third best pay-per-view year of all time, 2001. My name's Aaron. Thank you for joining me again this time. And if you had told me, at the beginning of all this, if you had told me that, like, 2001 would have finished this high when I started watching these years, I probably would have said that you're out of your mind. And then I would have, like, crippled myself with thundering doubts and, like, paralyzing self-loathing. It wouldn't have been good. It's good I didn't share this with anyone before. But this is the year, because this is the year of the botched invasion. Maybe the year they killed wrestling? And there's, like, a real clear demarcation point between before and after 2001. Things would actually never be the same again, and that's not hyperbole. And, like, imagine now sitting here, God, 20 years later, right? And, you know, longing for the logic and the logical and coherent storytelling of 2001. Now, things might have been all over the place, but at least it was exciting and new. I think one of the biggest advantages of 2001 was the influx of new guys to the promotion that opened up a ton of new matchups. The other is that they actually started taking some real risks with their characters. I mean, say what you want about the timing of the Steve Austin heel turn, but look, if you didn't pop when Steve Austin hugged Vince and then stared off into space as though he'd lost his whole family in a fire, look, I don't know what to tell you then, right? Ultimately, I think 2001 also benefits the most from the system that I kind of built for this project. Now, I didn't build it with 2001 in mind, but I think it actually is the one that benefits the most. And it's not that the year isn't good, but this system is always going to advantage years that have a strong Royal Rumble match, a strong WrestleMania, and a strong SummerSlam. Because those are kind of the, for me, and one of the reasons why I made it a point to include those, is those are kind of the tent poles of the year. You remember the Royal Rumble match, you remember WrestleMania, you remember the SummerSlam, right? I was thinking about it today, and there's a few years, not many, that have a great iteration of each. And really, the only ones I could come up with were like 1992, if you think that SummerSlam is great. 1994, again, you have to think that SummerSlam's great, which, you know, is iffy. And 2005, I think 2005 SummerSlam is definitely great. And to give you some context, 1992 finished fourth, 1994 finished seventh, and 2005 finished 20th. But 2005 seems to be the exception. The more I think about it, the more it seems to make sense that if you have a great Rumble, a great Mania, and a great SummerSlam, then you're probably doing a good job of writing stories for your four divisions, so hence you finish higher in a system that tries to give credit to giving emphasis to all of these divisions. Anyway, enough with the stats jargon. Let's tackle the year. If you're new to the podcast, you jumped on at the bronze medal episode. I've been doing this for about a year, this project, and I'm sure my first episodes are not, I mean, they're probably, maybe they're okay. I don't know. But look, if this is your first one, I'd ask you to go back and see if you like the other ones too. But if you want to just jump in here, I rank the years on 12 categories, give bonuses for 4-star plus matches, punishments for 1-star or less. This gives us our rankings. Once again, thank you so much to everyone who has supported this podcast, who has shared in the comments, who has shared the podcast. If you've just written me and say, hey, I liked it, you can't understand how much each one of those comments means to me. So thank you. That's what keeps a project like this going. It's not for monetary value. It's really just, it means a lot to me that people seem to like it. All right, here we go. Third place. Fuck, I can't believe this is almost done. So I wasn't going to touch through lines, but I want to get to a couple of because I found when I was reading the comments for 2001, it was very much a polarizing year, and there seemed to be kind of two camps, which I thought was interesting. And I thought I'd represent that in our through lines. So let's hear from Dave Hall. Man from Down Under, Dave Hall. Dave Hall says, I must admit, I was very surprised to see this year rank so highly. 2001 was a year of some amazing in-ring action and some great character development. Steve Austin as a maniacal egomaniac was fantastic, and Kurt Angle as the man vying with Austin for McMahon's acceptance was hilarious, before battling him for the title of number one wrestler in the company. Paul Heyman brings a breath of fresh air to the commentary, and WrestleMania that year is one of the best ever. One of. Interesting. However, I also feel that this is always going to be the year of missed opportunity. No matter how good the in-ring work or the character development, 2001 will always be remembered for the botched invasion storyline, the failure to truly capitalize of the opportunity presented by the WWF, and the collapse of WCW. Sadly, it left a sour taste in my mouth. Yeah, and that's what I thought going in. I thought, oh, I'm not going to like this year because of this. Now, to give the counterpoint, Mr. Ben Morse, Mighty Ben Morse, says, this might be my personal favorite. So I thought that these were really two interesting counterpoints, because you can get soured by the invasion, and I get it, right? And we'll talk about that later when we talk about the historical importance of it. But when you're just watching the pay-per-views, holy shit, they're good. So I think that's the balance, right? But both are totally valid. I mean, any opinion's valid. But both are totally valid takes on 2001, I think. First category we rank these years in, matches. I have this ranked 8th out of 36 years. The average star rating for this one was 3.066. So, on average, the matches from 2001 were good. Of the 36 years we dealt with, only 11 years crack 3 stars on average. So, only a third of the time, the matches are on average good. For me, 3 stars is a good match. And like, man, isn't that crazy? A third of the time, only a third of the time, the average match is good. Remind me why I keep watching this product year after year. 2001 is also the year that had the highest number of 4.25-star matches, but on the flip side, it had the most 1.5-star matches. 59% of the matches are good or great. Tremendous year from that perspective. Even better, though, only 9% of the matches are bad. So that's, for me, a bad match is under 2.25 stars. There are only 3 years that have 2001 bested in terms of having the least amount of bad matches. And that is 2015, 2016, and a year we haven't dealt yet. But 9% is crazy. So even when the matches aren't good in 2001, they're more middling than anything else. And that's, you know, in a way, that's not great too, but it's better than the being outright bad. And in this year, when matches are bad, it almost all falls at the feet of people who are either not wrestlers, or it's really just awful booking decisions in the match. So when the WWE now, recently put out their greatest tag teams of all time list, they clearly ignored the 2001 of the Brothers of Destruction. When they wrestle as a tag team, the results are always the same. The Power Trip match is their best match of 2001 at 2.25. Then DDP Canyon, and then the Chronic matches are all-time bad. That's a third of the bad matches right there. And the six that are left are either inexperienced women or referees parading as wrestlers. And then I look at the glut of three-star plus matches, and I see a ton of Edge, Christian, the Dudleys, the Hardys, be in the tag division or separate. They're just producing. It's interesting that they start splitting them up, and they start having good matches as a consequence. Then you get the guys coming in from ECW and WCW. And look, there's no surprise the year is good in the ring. But there can only be one worse match. And this worst match of the year, really, it's more... It really just finishes last because it's just a complete and utter regard for the audience's intelligence. And to me, those are actually the worst kind of matches. So, for me, the worst match of 2001... From the Royal Rumble, Ivory versus China. I have it at half a star. So I rewatched it, like I try to rewatch all of these worst matches. Right away, the right to censor music is completely inspired. There is no possible way you could cheer with that fucking siren. Me, 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 me. You just can't. It makes your blood boil immediately. It's not just the siren. They've added a beep in there too. It's the beep. I don't know what Steven Richards is screaming at Ivory on the way down, but she just clearly looks annoyed. I still don't know how to treat China. Is she a woman? Like, don't treat her like a woman, like a man, like I know her. She shoots a bazooka. And I'm going to be honest with her, and I don't want to get any heat over this, but I am always alarmed by China's breasts. The reason being is that they're big on her. I can't even fathom the actual size. The match starts. China's just killing her. Good action to start. Ivory, after all these years, still can't run the ropes. I don't understand. And Ivory's selling is also awful. So she's getting her ass kicked for like 2 straight minutes. But then she's just jumping up and running around like nothing's happened. Like the match has never happened. China press slams Ivory. Like it's really actually impressive. Like her strength is good. And as I'm watching this, like... Man, it's such a shame that China wasn't, like, this version of China, like, imagine 2001 China was around today, right? Like, at that age, like, she was just younger. Like, imagine she comes in with the Women's Revolution. She'd fit right in. Also, she probably wouldn't have her life ruined by Triple H. And don't give me that, she had her demons, gang. She had a demon. Some bullshit like that, okay? One, you're not JR. And two, they fucked her over big time, okay? I get it with Triple H. I know Stephanie was probably the career move. But man, every time you hear China in an interview, even the old ones, like, man, she comes off as a much nicer person, at least. Anyway, back to the match. She beats up Richards. She does that handspring flip. And somehow, I don't know how, she breaks her neck. And I don't know how it happened. Nothing looked like it would snap. Then China starts acting paralyzed in the ring. And the announcers go into the Owen Hart voices. Oh, you know, a lot of stuff happens and it's not always part of the show. Like, and instead of the EMTs running to the ring, like medical expert Jerry Lawler is the first on the scene. You mean to tell me that no one backstage was watching? You could see that she broke her neck. Billy Gunn runs out to cheers, which should tell you all you need to know about how invested the crowd is in this moment. And like, she's clearly playing paralyzed. And there's a doctor that looks like Kevin from The Office lumbering over her. Finally, a woman runs out, slaps a neck brace on her without even checking her. Billy Gunn helps her onto the plank in a move that no one would ever allow this wrestler to lift her onto a plank. Man, how over would Billy Gunn be if he took that plank and baseball batted her into the ring post like Big Show did to Rey Mysterio? Like he baseball bats her on the board or skull crushes to the ground. He stands over doing crotch chops. Fuck, man. Even if that had happened right there and she died right there in the ring, it would somehow be less sad than what actually happened to her. And the WWE would somehow be less responsible for it. Man, what a depressing match. Almost as depressing as early TNA. Right? Awful BG James, dying Kurt Hennig, Nazis. JT, Jenny Smith, and I break down every other Tuesday on North-South Connection Podcast Network, NWA TNA action from the very beginning. A chore to watch, but a pleasure to record as JT and Jenny are super pros. They're able to put up with any insanity I give them on the show. And the same counterpoint to TNA Never Dies, which airs every other Tuesday, are the soothing sounds of Jacob Williams' Ruthlessly Aggressive podcast. Jake brings in a guest every other Tuesday to discuss the ruthless aggression era. And he's right in the thick of the heaven and hell portion of the WWE history as he gets to cover the glory of 2002 SmackDown and the sheer fucking brimstone of 2002 Raw. Anyway, Jake kills it every other Tuesday on the North-South Connection Podcast Network. Let's deal with the top five matches of the year. But I got some honorable mentions. As you know, usually I will give any match that breaks 4 stars an honorable mention, and there's a ton of them here. So here come the honorable mentions for match of the year. At 4 stars, the Royal Rumble match, The Rock versus Chris Jericho from WCW Vengeance. Not WCW Vengeance, for the WCW title at Vengeance. Number four, still at 4 stars, Rob Van Dam versus Chris Jericho for the hardcore title from Unforgiven, forgotten little great match, and Chris Benoit versus Kurt Angle from WrestleMania. At 4 1/4, Chris Benoit versus Chris Jericho, the ladder match from the Royal Rumble for the Intercontinental title. Steve Austin versus Chris Jericho versus Chris Benoit, the triple threat for the WWF Championship from the King of the Ring. Still at 4 1/4, Chris Jericho versus Chris Benoit, a lot of these guys, versus X-Pac versus Eddie Guerrero, the four-way dance for the Intercontinental title from No Way Out, the winner-take-all match at the Survivor Series, that's the big 10-man tag, The Rock versus Chris Jericho, No Mercy, for the WCW Championship, and Steve Austin versus Kurt Angle from Unforgiven for the WWF title, that's the Kurt Angle win. We're at 4.5 stars, we're still not in our top five. Kurt Angle versus The Rock from No Way Out for the WWF Championship. I know I'm high on these, but man, I love them. Jeff Hardy versus Rob Van Dam, hardcore from Invasion. The 10-man tag from Invasion. Steve Austin versus Triple H, 3 Stages of Hell from No Way Out. All at 4.5 stars. And here we go with the top five matches of the year. Number five. From the King of the Ring, Kurt Angle versus Shane McMahon, 4.5 stars. Man, this thing was brutal. And it put Angle over as he's even more of a killing machine, as if he needed that, right? And those glass spots. Jesus Christ, those glass spots. Not only did they look insane, but they made Angle look like just a madman. He's just determined to get Shane McMahon through them. Just this whole thing is just a crazy hardcore match from start to finish with... I love the tremendous off-the-top rope Angle slam to finally put Shane away. And it's crazy. Coming, you would even imagine. Coming out of this match, it's Kurt Angle that's injured. Anyway, like this was brutal to watch first time. I loved it on rewatch. Go out of your way to see it. At 4 3/4 stars, number 4, The Rock versus Stone Cold Steve Austin for the WWF Championship at WrestleMania. I'm sure some people have this higher. I have it 4 3/4. Epic in every single way, with the crowd going insane for every single moment. Now, I'm not the hugest fan. I love the Austin heel turn, and we'll probably talk about that. I'm not exactly the biggest fan of the McMahon version of the Austin heel turn. It just feels out of place. But I'm a huge fan of Austin needing to beat The Rock down repeatedly with a chair to finally get the win. Because I'm always like, why is he stopping? Why is he stop hitting him with the chair? Why doesn't he just keep beating him with the chair till he's jelly? And that's what Austin does here. He just pummels him till he's jelly and pins him. And it completely fits with the narrative they're trying to tell, that Austin is desperate and needs to win. And this is a story they could have easily told without Vince. Without the Vince Alliance. Which I thought, more than being out of place, slowed the match down to a crawl. Like, I can picture Austin just losing it and killing him with the chair without Vince. I think that would have been magic on its own. Number 3, best match of the year. Steve Austin versus Kurt Angle versus Rob Van Dam, No Mercy triple threat match for the WWF Championship. 4 3/4 stars. So, listen, this one, I know I'm high on, right? And so I figured I'd rewatch it, because I think I might have... I didn't watch these years in chronological order. I thought that there's no way I could have gotten through the mid-2000s if I would have watched these years in chronological order. So I kind of bounced around a lot. And 2001 was actually one of the first years I watched. I want to say it was like the 4th or 5th, which, you know, is near the first. So, and I have this at 4 3/4. I have it ahead of Rock Austin at WrestleMania. So I wanted to watch it again just to see. So here are my thoughts on it. I turn it on, and right away, decent cheer for Angle. He had a great summer. contrast with a massive pop for Rob Van Dam. And I'd forgotten he was hardcore champion going into this. He's really the winner of the whole alliance. He's the only one who comes out good. Austin comes out in his weird-ass WCW music, which I like. But he's like stopping and middle-fingering the fans right in their faces. And I love, too, that he's chasing off the cameraman. It's just good character stuff. The match starts, and the whole concept of the match is Austin and RVD are part of the alliance together, and Angle's kind of on his own. And Austin starts the match by giving Rob Van Dam some orders. Great character stuff. But then Angle jumps in and starts giving him Germans. And it just starts. It starts with crazy high action. Suplexes like crazy to both guys to start. Then Austin and Van Dam team up. They start kicking Angle down. Van Dam and Austin get rid of Angle. They tease they're going to go at it. Austin middle fingers him. Rob Van Dam does his Rob Van Dam pose. And the crowd goes ballistic. But before Van Dam and Austin go at it, Angle's back in. The fight is on. Austin's now taking a fighting RVD too. And so it's this great spot where RVD's in one corner and Angle's in another. And Austin's like running between the two to either kick one down, run to the other guys, kick one down. Like there's an urgency to Austin's work here, which is really good. Austin goes to kick Angle in the stomach. Angle catches it and Austin has a very loud, "Shit!" RVD breaks it up, though, and everything so far is just an incredible sprint. RVD starts flying around. The crowd is biting on everything. RVD flips through a German, kicks Angle in the face, rolling thunder. I'm trying to keep up with how fast this match is. Huge RVD chant. And the organization of this match is also really great and special. As soon as one guy goes out, the other two go crazy on each other. There are no lulls. And now Austin starts smartly working RVD's leg to floor him to get rid of the aerial offense, right? Great half Boston crab by Austin and RVD. But again, this match is so smart, he's only in it for 5 seconds before Angle interrupts. STF on RVD by Austin, and he fucking pulls back. He follows his own advice that he gives to John Cena. He tightens that shit up on RVD. And again, RVD's barely in it before Angle interrupts. And then Austin and Angle go to the outside. The brawl is on. Austin is fighting Angle and wrestling RVD. I think that's the story of the match. He's fighting Kurt Angle. He's wrestling RVD. I love the strategy. Angle and Austin go into the crowd. Maybe that's why it's not 5 stars for me. Then Van Dam flips out into both guys. And we get the first break in the match. The first point where everybody's kind of lying down. And it's like 8 minutes into the match. But then RVD's right back up right away. It breathed for 15 seconds. That was enough. Angle catches a kick. So RVD gets in with Angle. He goes to kick Angle. Angle catches the kick and hits a sick capture suplex. Angle then hits the moonsault on RVD. Austin sneaks in for a very close two count. And then Austin and Angle trade stunner attempts. Double clothesline. Now, normally when you get a double clothesline, you're leading to the 10 count where the referees count. One, two, getting to 10, right? So you got this long pause, but nope. RVD tries a 5-star frog splash on both. Now Angle's revved up again. Sweet German suplex with the bridge. And he would have gotten 3 on RVD, but Austin stepped in. Angle eats a stunner. RVD saves him. Fuck, RVD with a split-legged moonsault. Everything RVD's doing is so tight. Angle gets a knee to the outside, leaving RVD and Austin. And this is the first time they're really alone. Austin does not go after RVD. Instead, follows Angle out. And his energy, Austin's energy when he's attacking Angle is such next level stuff. You can see he's like, "I'm going to get you." This is seriously the tightest, to this point, the tightest three-way I've ever seen. You would think they choreographed it and practiced it to death. RVD flies out of the ring, nails them both. Here comes Vince. Angle starts killing RVD with chops and punches. It's really violent. Angle's punches and chops look real legit. And I just feel RVD gives zero fucks about getting hurt. And RVD goes up. Angle does that jump up suplex that always pops the audience. Austin hits a stunner on a hurt Angle, but Angle falls outside the ring. And Austin like desperately tries to grab him. And Austin's left with RVD, and he starts laughing because RVD is ripe for the pickings. But then Vince runs in and crushes Austin with a chair. Van Dam goes up for the 5-star. He hits it, and man, the crowd believes. And the crowd believes when he hits that 5-star. And RVD is so cool. I love that he sells. I've never seen anybody else do this. He sells that his finishing move hurts him. Anyway, Angle saves Austin and the crowd boos. Angle repeatedly suplexes RVD. Austin's busted open from the chair. Four suplexes, Angle slam. Shane then jumps in to save RVD, and the crowd does not. The crowd boos, which is interesting. And then Vince and Shane go at it. The crowd goes crazy. RVD's dead. He's been killed by Angle. Like, Angle destroyed RVD. And then Austin just picks him up and stunners him and pins him. Austin's bleeding everywhere. I mean, look. So the three count, Austin wins. RVD probably shouldn't have taken the pin, but fuck, this one holds up and more. It's not perfect, mainly because of the interference, but holy hell, it's a sprint. And it's nearly perfectly executed from a technical standpoint. As soon as one guy gets knocked around, the next guy is in to keep the action moving. The tightest, I know I mentioned earlier, but it's the tightest, most fast-paced triple threat I've ever seen. Plus, the three guys, they're all masters. They all work so well, they all bring a different element. Angle's bringing the ground, Austin's bringing the emotion, RVD's bringing the air. It's been totally lost of time, this one. It's a second look if you're down on it. My score stays 4.75. The second best match of the year. TLC 2 from WrestleMania, WWF Tag. I mean, look, you know the score here. Three teams going at it, killing each other. It's Edge and Christian versus the Hardys versus the Dudleys. All the crazy spots, including the all-timer of Edge spearing Jeff Hardy off the rung. And I love how all these matches built on the ones that came before. And this was a tremendous culmination. It also included everyone's significant other or brother getting involved. So, like, you know, Spike joins the Dudleys, Lita the Hardys, and Rhino helps out his friends, Edge and Christian. Which leads us to the best match of the year from the SummerSlam. Stone Cold Steve Austin versus Kurt Angle for the WWF Championship. And you know you're in for a special match when the video package gets you excited to watch it again. And I think the best book matches are the ones in which you can't really see either guy losing. Look, you can call it booking yourself into a corner, but if you just pull the trigger, you can easily have a classic on your hands. And this match is just a war between the two of the best of at the time, and definitely maybe two of the best of all time. It tells a great story, too, of how Austin just can't beat Angle no matter what he does. Angle's a machine, right? And he's on his way to becoming this incredible babyface that no one could have even imagined he would be the year before. The timing of this match, the action, it's all pitch perfect. There's a moment late in the match after Austin hits Angle with a stunner. Angle kicks out, then Angle crawls up Austin. Austin's standing over him and he kind of crawls up Austin and he gets to his feet. Stone Cold slaps him a bunch of times, then goes for the kick for another stunner. Angle catches it and turns it into an Angle slam. That is as perfect a moment as you can do. And if the match had ended there, I think we're talking about one of the greatest matches in company history. I think it's up there with the Bret Harts and Austins and with the Punk and Cena and all that. Because it would have been such an amazing culmination, right? As it stands, without that moment, it's still a classic in my mind. It's just a fight between two of the best in the world. And everybody's on edge for the whole time, popping for the false finishes. Kurt's color and the blood he pours out only adds to the drama. And the story of the crazed champion unable to beat his surging challenger is one for the ages. The DQ works, I think. For me, it doesn't take away. It's still an all-timer from SummerSlam 01. The next category, we rank these years in characters. I have it 12th out of 36. And if you like a deep dive into characters, check out Second Print Comics every Sunday on North South. Mark Claire and Remzo Martinez are an absolute pleasure to listen to every week. And they're timely, too. In their last episode, they reviewed the Black Widow movie and did a fantastic job breaking everything down. Second Print Comics every Sunday. So, characters in 2001 are interesting. 12th out of 36. That's not bad. It's in the upper third. Let's take a look at some of them. So, Edge. Edge is a guy who has teeth and a very pointy jaw. He was still trying to channel his Reeking of Awesomeness character, all the while trying to move up the card. I guess he was still brothers with Christian. And their grandmother loved one of them more than the other. This was the extent of their character development throughout the year. That, and for some reason, he decided to shit on Billy Gunn after he won the King of the Ring. He won the King of the Ring with a much weaker field than Billy Gunn did. And, like, I'm not a huge Billy Gunn fan, but, like, it's not exactly his fault. That they booked him in a match that involved kissing another man's ass after he won the King of the Ring? Did Billy Gunn create the Kiss My Ass Club? Thanks, Billy. Billy Gunn is also very progressive this year in that he was portrayed in a platonic relationship with China that was devoid of anything nearing sexual tension. He just loved her as a friend, damn it. And it's sad, right? That, like, of all the DX, I guess it's not sad, but of all the DX guys, Billy Gunn probably would have made the best life partner for China in the group. Jerry Lawler hated censorship. Man, would he have hated the political discourse of 2021. And look, don't tell me he's still alive, okay? Because that poor guy's been dead inside since WrestleMania 27. Stephanie McMahon was a raging bitch, which I'm sure is a crazy stretch for her. I've never seen someone go so power hungry with so little power. Oh yeah? You're going to insult me? Then I'm going to send Rhino after you. Fuck, I'm just glad she wasn't making baby faces cry yet. China, despite being repeatedly told not to treat her as such, was officially deemed a woman in 2001, and then she was asked to leave. Al Snow still sucked. William Regal became a hugely entertaining comedy figure. His heart-to-hearts with Tajiri were second only to the man who called him Tajiri. As for Regal, look, the guy made an angle where a dude pisses in his tea work. Look, he's a miracle worker. Saturn and Raven seemed to be in a combination to see who could be the most filthy. It's like, do you really want to be portrayed as like the walking representation of hepatitis? Like, Tommy Lee has had that title wrapped up since about 1996. So why even go against him? And damn Tommy Lee for infecting Pamela Anderson, who would infect Kid Rock. And who knows how many pregnant strippers got infected as a result? Chris Benoit was masquerading as a functional human being. Big Show was a hardcore guy until he needed to be the savior of the WWF at the Survivor Series. Steve Blackman was still hanging around, but sadly never made the transition to Raver that his music was like begging for him to accomplish. The Hardys love to jump off things. Seriously, that's the extent of their characters. If you place a ledge or some sort of a rickety structure in front of them, they will jump off of it. It's like they're fucking moths hiding right into the flames. What a weird weakness to have. And fuck moths, right? Why? Why do their bodies make such a mess when your child kills one by mistake climbing into bed? No other body explodes that way. I mentioned both Tajiri and Tajiri earlier, but holy shit, could this guy kick. He was just a crazy Japanese guy who managed to bed the most beautiful WWF woman of all time. Christ, he even pulled her out of the alliance. Also, I love that his kicks could legit win a match against anyone, as he was a constant threat to win despite being booked like a jobber half the time. So Trish Stratus, what to say? So she was a whore, a homewrecker, or a barking dog, depending on the week. Why would she date Vince? Right? Like, I'm guessing like one of the writers was like, you know, women only date assholes. Who's the biggest piece of shit in the promotion? Oh yeah, let's put her with Vince. I thought the whole right to censor was like a tremendous idea in theory, but not the best in execution. And besides their music, which was sheer perfection. And while I do like that they recruited like ruffians like the Godfather and Val Venus, by Godfather to Goodfather, stroke of genius, by the way. But the stable just didn't really have anyone who could really hang in the ring. And that was a bit of a problem, right? Like, was D'Lo Brown no longer available? Maybe Billy Kidman, right? Could have done this instead of, I don't know, nothing. Fuck, even X-Pac would have been an upgrade from Steven Richards and boring Bill Buchanan. Test had long hair, leather pants, zero allegiance or sense of right and wrong. Of all the guys in the Battle Royal, he's the one who gets immunity. And he's the one who gets the tag title around Booker T. And he's the one who gets the Intercontinental title. Like, what the fuck? You didn't want to push him in 1999 when he was at his most over, but you push him here? And just wait, 6 years later, it's going to feel even more insane. I guess The Undertaker got old. I don't really know how else to describe it. And he starts the year as like the American badass, but by year end, he's cut off all his hair and stands in the ring as his boss dances a cowboy dance with a pair of pants around his ankles. I mean, besides the nonsensical bullshit with the Kiss My Ass Club, I actually really dug the reinvention of The Undertaker. He's someone who, like, he's difficult to boo by 2001, but they do a great job of making him, like, a piece of liquid human shit. Not to mention, with Old Man Undertaker, we get his old man selling, which is really a sight to behold. We also got an influx of guys from WCW. Lance Storm starts the invasion, and boy, does he peak quickly. I was actually shocked when he won the Intercontinental title. But, I mean, he had nothing to offer in terms of a compelling character, so he's quickly shunted down the undercard. Mike Awesome came into the promotion, won a title, and was promptly told to kill himself by the writers. Now, I'll be honest, I didn't know. I felt bad writing the jokes. I did some research, and I checked. I wanted to see if he was actually dead, and he is. By hanging, so I'm sorry. Fuck. Chuck Palumbo and Sean O'Hare were up-and-coming young guys with a tremendous future. But I know that when I looked at them, I was thinking, you know what? You know what would be much better? If one of them was like a bad version of your conscience and the other was like a pretend homosexual. Also, it'd probably be better if they stopped wrestling like unique individuals and did all the same stuff that all the other guys in the promotion do. You know, learn our style. Booker T was a 5-time champion. That's all he needed to say. That's all we needed to know. Sean Stasiak was an idiot. I think that's actually his character. Also, he was from Planet Stasiak, and he liked to rhyme. For about a year, my son Austin told me he came from Austin Planet, and he was sent here to live a different life than the one he had back home. And then he was 5 when he was coming up with this stuff. He was 5 and had the same character as Sean Stasiak on a professional wrestling show, the number one professional wrestling show in the world. When Stasiak wasn't telling everyone he was the last son of a dying planet, he was running into frame and crashing into things. Hugh Morris is a guy that never should have been on WWF TV. I mean, everything about him, from his name to his ridiculous beard, screams small time. I mean, Steve Austin dressing him down and like insulting his name still ranks as one of my favorite moments in the history of Raw. Well, you're supposed to be humorous. Shane Helms comes in as Sugar Shane Helms, and by the end of the year was part of the goddamn Green Lantern Corps. Taz was bullied. Man, I'd definitely be remiss if I didn't mention the awesomeness that was Alliance MVP Canyon. To this day, I still place in every theatrical program that I create, like the programs get handed out, somewhere in the program the words, "Who better?" and always a special thanks to Canyon. I don't know why, but his speech he gives Austin during Austin Appreciation Night is one of my favorites. For years, the question has always been, who better than Canyon? Well, now we know, Stone Cold, it's you. It's you. All-time favorite stuff there. This year would also not be where it was without the stellar commentary of Jim Ross and Paul Heyman. I think this is Jim Ross's last great year before he descends into yelling about slobber knockers and incessantly screaming about burning dogs with water. I think Heyman challenged him, and their dynamic was a massive improvement over what he and King had been giving us. And it's not like he and King were bad. It's just the dynamic of two commentators hating each other had been missing for a while. I mean, you can hear the hate in JR's voice as he's like, well, why don't you have a parade, you know? Plus, Heyman as a sycophant for Steve Austin throughout the year is magnificent. Man, I wish we had him for more than a year. So DDP had a thing for Sarah Undertaker, who they called Sarah Undertaker on an episode of the show. And that's just not me trying to be funny. That was her surname. Her surname was Undertaker. They never did that with anybody else. We never got Lita Hardy or Samantha Big Show. Why on earth would the dude who is married to Kimberly Page start stalking Undertaker's less attractive wife? To get noticed? Fine. Maybe he could win? I don't know. One match of their feud? And not get pinned by Sarah Undertaker? Why did poor Canyon have to get involved in this too? He wasn't stalking the wife of Kane Bearer. Albert morphed from large, scary man to large, fun-loving man who liked to dance. Imagine this is only the first time they do this exact same transformation with this guy. Imagine failing so hard at being the heavy twice that they twice make you into the fat guy that can dance. They call him the hip-hop hippo. You can't be taken seriously if you're named after a hippopotamus. It's too silly a word. No one takes hippopotami seriously, and they kill more people every year than the coronavirus. X-Pac was hated. So hated that in Invasion, he's the only WWF guy who gets booed. That being said, on rewatch, I was happy to see him. And he did an awesome job of building and maintaining that heat. Also, without X-Pac, We never get X Factor and that goddamn song about them. I got everything I ever wanted and I'm gonna live on that. Oh, God. God. So good. I do love how these guys, too, like the X Factor and Xbox, they live outside the whole invasion angle. Like, there's just this whole other thing that's happening on the show, right? And, like, it makes no sense because everyone else is so into the invasion. It's like Germany's invading Russia in World War II, and like, Kenya just shows up and starts telling both countries to suck their dicks. Like, it makes no sense in terms of what's happening in the show, which I like it. Deborah made cookies. They were bad. Chris Jericho became a main eventer this year, sort of. He did it in a way, in every way that WWF makes a main eventer, so that the second they're out of the title picture, they're shunted down the card and forced to fight Ric Flair at the second biggest show of the summer. But Jericho had a great run in 2001. He was the plucky babyface, which kind of climaxed at the King of the Ring when he and Benoit took Austin to the limit. Then in the summer, he's just a foe for Stephanie McMahon, who, despite a horrible miscue with The Rock, was generating some decent heat. Then Jericho became the guy who couldn't win the big one until he finally did. Then he ends the year as champion. Weird. The Rock, usual great self, his great character work as usual. And his character really is, he's a superstar, which doesn't seem that interesting, but Rock's so good he can make anything work. You know who else could make anything work? Dylan McKay. Find out all about his antics on 9021 No So, airing every 3 weeks or so on Fridays on North South. JT and Tim Capel are starting at the beginning of 90210 and watching the series that got me bullied incessantly by our live-in cousin Simon. Simon, I hate you, okay? You probably also gave me body dysmorphia to this day. Anyway, the 90210 podcast, obviously great for fans of the show or closet fans like myself. Also on Friday, we get Susan and Sean killing it, bringing us modern Impact Wrestling, which has really come a long way from its humble beginnings. The show's great. It's a cool addition to the network. Back to the characters. Shane McMahon. He bought WCW, and then as soon as he beat his father at WrestleMania, became the most annoying man on the planet. But then again, he always took a great shit-kicking and always put guys over. In a lot of ways, he's like his dad. Vince started the year as possibly the worst human being on the planet. Not only was he blatantly cheating on his wife on television, but then he publicly demanded a divorce and announced that he could never forgive Linda for giving birth to his son Shane. Next, he entered a quasi-father-son relationship with both Steve Austin and Kurt Angle before taking on the role of intrepid promoter fighting off a deadly invasion led by a guy who a year ago was named after a boner. Then he goes mad with power, starts getting guys to kiss his ass. Hey, look, at least you can't say the character didn't have some development. He also wasn't calling anybody the product of his semen yet, so again, we're not really off the deep end yet. Triple H had to be the scariest guy around, man. Once again, he was presented with the opportunity to be the biggest face in the promotion, decided not to go with it. The night after WrestleMania, when he comes down to stop Austin, the crowd was all in. We would have even maybe forgiven his lack of vulnerability when Angle was trying to bang his wife the year before. All we wanted was the ass kicker to come in and teach Austin a lesson. But no, he joined him and started the worst 2 months of the year. Kurt Angle started the year goody-goody, like he was, but over the course of one match with The Rock, transformed into the killing machine that would be his defining characteristic for the rest of his career. It's like they suddenly realized, like, that this dude had another gear in him and allowed him to explore it. There's definitely a before and after the tap, Rock, or I'll break your fucking ankle. From that point on, he was never a joke again. Then, after nearly killing the boss's son, he becomes a great American hero. Then a mole. I guess the less said about that, the better. Let me hear from Mark Leslie. Mark Leslie writes, best year ever, or third, but the best. It introduced me to RVD, who I'd only seen in magazines, and as a young 10-year-old who had only been watching wrestling a few years, still enjoyed the invasion. Thanks, Mark. I put you here because, yeah, Rob Van Dam took the promotion by storm. And it took me a while to figure out, what's his character, right? Was he a stoner, a daredevil, an evil invader? And I'm sure there's elements that play, all these things play a role in his character. But I'm always taken back to the 2000 film Gladiator. And Proxima, who's kind of the owner of the Gladiators, played by the great Oliver Reed, tells Maximus, win the crowd if you want to win your freedom. And I feel like Van Damme is trying to win the crowd in every single one of his matches, more so than anybody else. And so is his character, to me, I'm like, what's his character? Okay, his character is like a gladiator. A gladiator trying to win, but also win the approval of the crowd. Yes, he's trying to win the matches, but he's doing it in such a way that the crowd rallies behind him on every step. And I think that justifies some of his big moves that may seem nonsensical. It justifies while he's always doing poses and while he's always pointing at himself or mugging to the crowd. I mean, look, the dude's a legit badass too. Finally, in characters, what a year for Steve Austin. And yes, it all makes sense. Austin is on a comeback since late 2000, and he's not sure he's got it anymore. So he wins the Rumble, but he has to cheat to do it. And this gives him a date with The Rock for the title at WrestleMania, and he has to beat him. This is hammered home in the pre-match promos. He has to prove himself and has to prove that he still has it. And during the course of the match, he kind of proves that he doesn't have it. He can't beat The Rock. Later, he can't beat Angle. So then he aligns himself with a guy that he hated. Now he's not looking for champion. He's not looking for more championships, right? When he's aligned with Vince McMahon. Now, because he's unable to be the best, he's looking for love and validation. That's why he hugs Vince with the crazed, forlorn look in his eyes. That's why he competes with Kurt Angle for Vince's attention. He wants to be loved. That's why he joins the Alliance, because more than anything else, they show him love and appreciation. I mean, this is so clear when they have a huge appreciation party and they have his head as a pissed off bouncing ball leading in the sing-along. During this thing, too, like he starts to sense that just one guy doesn't love him because Taz wore a Taz shirt instead of a Steve Austin shirt. He makes him take the shirt off. He's going to whip him, right? He's even great at doing the dead-eyed take the shirt off. It's such a weird, unique character, someone who's looking for affection and love. I don't think we've ever seen it before or since. I love it. Of course, he always creates the what stuff, which today is beyond played out, but at the time, it was really fantastic. He even learned that violence wasn't always the answer, and that sometimes the best way to clear the tension between two guys is for them to sing a little song. I just think all his work this year is really brilliant. More than that, it was a huge risk. And I don't think it really paid off in the way the company would have hoped. Man, I wouldn't trade it for one more year of Austin stomping mud holes in guys. I hope it was creatively fulfilling for him, because to this day, I think it's some of the best creative work we've seen on any WWF programming. WrestleMania, second out of 36. And I think one of the assigned opinions you're given as a member of the internet wrestling community is, well, there's a few of them, but one of them is WrestleMania 17 is the best WrestleMania. Royal Rumble 92 is the best Rumble. Ric Flair is the best. Hulk Hogan's the worst. Ultimate Warrior sucks. And I do like how today some of those narratives are starting to crumble a little. And I really like this show. But I don't think it's the best WrestleMania, right? JT and I ranked every WrestleMania last year on No Holds Barred, every other Saturday on North South. This year, we're breaking down who is the best worker of a given month. So to this point, we've named the best performers all the way up to the month of August, which should air soon, as we're going to discuss who is Mr. The SummerSlam. Starting in September on No Holds Barred, we're going to develop and diving into what is the best WWF world title change, starting from the very beginning. Like, is the Pedro Morales win better than the infamous Jinder Mahal win? Well, we'll break it all down if we can find the fucking footage. Also on Saturdays, you get JT's mailbag once a month where he answers questions from the listeners. It's always a blast. Had one recently about the Money in the Bank, and I thought he did a great job picking out who the Money in the Bank winner should be for all the years where there wasn't a Money in the Bank. But it occurred to me that, fuck, Money in the Bank makes everything worse, right? But listen to his mailbag because it's totally worth your time. And once per month, you also get from Squared Circle to Silver Screen, which is Cowboy and Logan breaking down movies that either star wrestlers or about wrestling. And it's a fun, unique take. And it's an often ignored little subset of cinema. For some reason, has not been recognized at the Academy Awards. Anyway, back to WrestleMania. When JT and I ranked it on No Holds Barred, second. If I was ranking it personally, I might have it down a few more slots. Again, it's a great show, but I don't think it's the most consistent. And if your opinion on a couple of matches on the card is a bit down, that's where it could fall. Also, X7, stupid name. I think we can all agree. X7, X8, not good names. Man, poor Steve Blackman had a team with Grandmaster Sexay on the pre-show. What did he do? Right? Did he like toss a nunchuck through that giant portrait of Vince? Anyways, I don't remember this match, and I'm assuming most people haven't seen it, or they would have knocked the card down a few more pegs. All right, the show proper. Jericho and Regal, they go out and have a fine opener. It's a fun little match. Has Jericho defending the title and beating the bad guy. Nothing earth-shattering, but fun. 3-star match, and I think the 8th best intercontinental match of the year for me. The 6-man is next between the Right to Censor and APA and Taz. This was part of the attempted rehab of Taz after spending the last year losing to the announcers and the big boss man and his friend Bull, and also lasting 11 seconds in the Rumble. This is fine. 2.5. Kane wins the hardcore title from Raven. Also, the Big Show was involved. This is the match that almost killed the power for the whole show. But again, I like all three guys. It's a solid 3-star affair. I don't usually give all the star ratings, but I think it's interesting in this one, which is considered the greatest show of all time. Guerrero beats Test for the European title. Look, I know when I think of Europe, I think of Test. Imagine how embarrassed those poor Europeans were to have Test representing their continent. What's his name? Test? Test what? Test Undertaker? Look, despite Guerrero being involved in this one, a bit underwhelming, 2.75 stars. So far we're 4 matches in, nothing earth-shattering, nothing that screams best WrestleMania of all time, right? Angle and Benoit have a great match, but I think it's fair to say it's a bit disappointing. I love the wrestling segments early on in the match because it looks like an amateur competition, but I think the end left a little to be desired, the feet on the ropes, the quick finish. I have 4 stars for that. China kills Ivory in revenge for China breaking her own neck at the Rumble. Like, seriously, what did Ivory do? She just kind of stood there. You did the dumbass handspring with no momentum. Leave poor Amish Ivory out of your rage. Shane beats Vince. I think it's a great story match. I think it's 3.75, which is Vince's worst match at WrestleMania for me. That doesn't include that deadbeat Bret Hart. TLC 2, perfect culmination of the TLC matches, 5 stars. Gimmick Battle Royal is a ton of fun. I love it. If nothing else, just to see Bobby Heenan call WWF programming for the last time. Triple H and Undertaker go out and have a match. I know I'm low, 2.75. I think it's the worst of the Triple H Undertaker WrestleMania trilogy. Finally, Austin and Rock tear the house down. Phenomenal match. I think it's their best of the WrestleMania trilogy, 4.75. So no doubt a great show, but of the 11 main show matches, 5 are middling or just good. So if you're low on Vince Shane or Taker Triple H, I could easily see this one dropping, right? I think the show could have been helped by bringing the WCW guys on the show. Like, you have Lance Storm challenge Jericho in the opener, maybe an open challenge. Maybe the match is better, right? Hell, have Helms come in and win the light heavyweight title. And fuck it, instead of having Triple H versus Undertaker, have Undertaker versus Haku in a Haas match. Or have Haku fight Triple H in a loser gets crippled and never wrestles again match, and make that a real match. Although I really think the best way to improve this card is just to scrap the gimmick battle royal and replace it with the gimmick brawl for all tournament. I think, why are we just dumping this concept, right? The gimmick brawl for all. You got Bobby Heenan and Joe Rogan on commentary. UFC is a thing now, so you can have submissions. Round 1, you have the gobbledygooker choke up Bushwhacker Luke, give him permanent brain damage. Earthquake can jump on Typhoon's head till he's dead. Kamala eats the Repo Man. Brother Love loves Sergeant Slaughter into submission. Doink can beat Kimchi on points. Hillbilly Jim knocks Michael Hayes with a swift punch to the goddamn mouth. Nikolai Volkov crushes the goon with like his breadline finisher. And the Iron Sheik can humble Bushwhacker Butch. In the quarterfinals, Gobbledygooper rope-a-dopes Earthquake until he passes out from like a 10-count/heart attack. Kamala can eat Brother Love. Doink catches Hillbilly Jim in the Goga Plata for the submission. Nikolai Volkov scores 3 takedowns on the Sheik to advance. We can actually get the Sheik on the ground. Semifinals, Kamala eats the gobbledygooker with dressing and gravy. Doink knocks out Nikolai Volkov in the 3rd round. In the Brawl for All final, Kamala can break Doink's fucking arm with the Kimura for the tournament victory. Then he eats him. Anyway, there. Made it better. Who am I kidding? This show's great. I love it. It's a major reason why 2001 finishes so high. Let's hear from Eric Eels. Oh my, 2001, I feel, is the last real popular year for the casual fans before business cools off for a variety of reasons. WCW, closing, invasion storyline, etc. The Austin I'm guessing, turn was unnecessary, but he did the best job he could when he played up the paranoid, funny elements. Yes, I agree. Especially after the second turn when he joined the Alliance. Despite getting that big babyface pop from the Go Home Raw, when he shows up and beats everybody up with that pool cue. LOL. Unfortunately, he also starts the what chant that permeated for the next decade, depending on how you feel it was a good or a bad thing. Sorry, brother, it's longer than the last decade. Back to Eric. There's definitely the overuse of the ladder even in 2001. I was feeling tired of it because they overuse it so much. Five pay-per-views I can think of, and that one TLC on SmackDown. Definitely a lot of rushed booking, stuff like Christian turning on Edge feels like it's a natural progression, but then gets blown off in two pay-per-view matches, which is a shame because they never go back to it later. Yeah, I don't get that. I never got that. Like, it's like, do they want to put Christian on the Alliance? Why? Like, just use the Alliance guys. Anyway, thanks, Eric. World title storylines, 4th out of 36. This is way better than I remember it being. We get loser Kurt Angle to start the year, but he transforms into killer Kurt Angle. And, you know, also, whenever Rock is holding the world title, the period's immediately elevated. Then Steve Austin tells the story of someone, even a legend like Steve Austin, needing to win a world title. It's more than an objective for him. It's an obsession. The sit-down interview does wonders for the title that had bounced around a ton in the previous years. It wasn't enough for Austin just to be a great wrestler. He needed to prove himself by winning the championship. Man, when a guy cares that much about the title, it just clicks on every level. Austin would form the two-man power trip with lesbian lover Triple H, and during which they would defend against Kane, Undertaker. Yes, it's a low part of the year, but it feels important. And then we get Austin defending against the up-and-comers, Jericho, Benoit, and the feud was hot and believable. I will never forget Austin being on commentary, like complaining about, oh, I hate those knife-edge chops from Benoit. Now, I pointed out Kurt Angle became a killer at the beginning of the year, which, well, that matters now, because he was the one, as a face, to try and wrench the title back from Austin. Their SummerSlam match, I've talked about it, absolutely amazing. And then sometimes the company just falls ass backwards into something special. Now, I can't pretend to understand the pain felt during the September 11th attacks. I'm not even going to try, and I'm not even going to tell bad jokes about it, right? That being said, Angle winning the world title from Steve Austin in his hometown in the wake of that tragedy ended up being a pretty special moment. Not only does he make Austin tap, but the image of Angle on everyone's shoulders will be forever etched in my mind. It may be the single best moment of Angle's incredible career. I mean, Austin took it back a week later, but, you know, sometimes the moment's worth it. Austin holds it till the end of the year. Chris Jericho's crowned in the weakest possible way. I mean, if Booker T is the reason you win a WWF title in 2001, the company does not give a shit about you. So, the WWF title is in great hands all year. It's Angle, Austin, or The Rock. I mean, you can't really get better than that, right? Meanwhile, a new world title is added when Booker T brings over the WCW championship. Booker would almost immediately drop it to Kurt Angle as he was working his way through all the members of the Alliance, but then Booker won it right back before The Rock, of all people, ends up as WCW champion. I don't think I could imagine anyone weirder holding the WCW title than The Rock. It's basically the visual equivalent of The Miz holding the ECW championship in 1997. But The Rock carries it well enough. Then we get the great feud with Rock and Jericho, who start as reluctant partners and then evolve into bitter rivals. It's a great story. And then they bounce the title back and forth, with Jericho ultimately getting the last laugh. And what I love about the feud is that it gets so personal that it bleeds into the WWF versus WCW war. It's kind of the antithesis of the Edge-Christian turn. Edge and Christian should have been a personal feud that existed outside of this war. But it started as a personal feud, and then Christian just joined the Alliance, and then we were done. This is the opposite of that. Jericho is so involved in the feud for the WCW title that he's able to turn heel without resorting to joining the Alliance. And while that may seem like a small detail, it's rare in 2001. The world title changed hands 13 times from 1999 to 2000. It's a hot potato. In 2001, it changed 5 times, but every single one felt important and earned. You know when the title rarely changed hands? In the New Generation era. Justin Pratt and Tim Slomka are diving deep into that in New Gen on a Mission every other Wednesday on the North-South Connection Podcast Network. And what I love about their show is that you don't just get the pay-per-views with these two. They also take you all over the place with Superstars and Raw. And boy, do some of these shows sound like they're fucking terrible. But JP and Tim make it fun each and every time out. Imagine these poor guys having to discuss Typhoon at length, right? This is some yeoman's work that they are doing for you, right? They're digging through. They're watching old Bob Backlund matches, right? This runs in tandem with myself and Johnny C. We're launching WCW Must Die. We're looking at WCW from the relaunch in April 2000. Is Vince Russo trying to kill it or just trying to kill me? Find out every other Wednesday on the North-South Connection Podcast Network. James Grunberg. Let's hear from James Grunberg. I am very surprised that this isn't number one. There is so much meat on that bone. WrestleMania 17 is the best, in my opinion. This also might be the year of injuries as well. Triple H's quad, Benoit's neck, and the King of the Ring street fight is a once-in-a-lifetime thing that proves how tough Shane McMahon is. This year does have a downside, the end of competition with the closures of ECW and WCW. And the invasion fails because not all the talent is there, but that's not WWE's fault. Interesting take. I will counter. My buddy Reg and I did a podcast a few months ago about the invasion, and our general thesis was that it never had to happen. They should have just not done it when they did. So I think it is WWE's fault because they got greedy and wanted to do it right away. They should have held off until either people were ready or they could bring in the best talent. Let me hear from Rob Kindler. Rob asks, do you think if Hunter hadn't gotten hurt, it would have improved or hurt the year? Rob, buddy, this is the easiest question I've ever had to answer. Obviously, it's better he's not there, right? And I don't think that's just me. I mean, look, obviously, I have bias against Triple H. But listen, here's why I actually think it's better that he wasn't there. If Hunter's there, the invasion becomes about him. For sure. Also, if Hunter's there, you don't get Kurt Angle as the challenger in the summer. And I think that's such a magical period for Kurt. I think he's just really great. You lose the Austin. It's probably Austin Triple H at SummerSlam. So, yeah, I don't want to say I'm glad he got hurt because I think that's probably a bit too far. But I'm glad he wasn't there because I think it is actually better with him not being there. And ultimately, they would have botched the invasion anyway. So Hunter out, Angle in. Easy choice. Thanks, Rob. Mid-card storyline, 21 out of 36. Canyon is the U.S. champion, also is the best. Tajiri, of all people, takes the title off him. Then it bounces around, ends up on the waist of Edge. The Intercontinental title doesn't fare much better this year. There's 12 title changes in the year. 12. The year starts off well enough. Great ladder match, Jericho and Benoit. It's a brutal contest, and you could probably pinpoint the exact moment where Chris Benoit loses his mind. It's the chair shot, which I guess is one more thing the anti-AEW guys can get angry at Chris Jericho for. He left the company and said bad things about a billion-dollar company. Let's get him. We also enter a weird period where Triple H decides he wants to be the Intercontinental Champion again, so he gets to crush Jericho again. Man, what a different world we live in if Jericho had married Stephanie instead. I mean, she probably would have left him by now because of his alcoholism, but at least Triple H would have spent the rest of his career trying to impress Gabe Sapolsky enough to carry his belt. Anyway, he gets to say he puts over guys by dropping the title to Jeff Hardy, and then immediately beats Jeff Hardy. What a great guy. Interesting enough, Kane wins the title, and that feels right. That feels like justice. Triple H messed with the wrong guy, Kane wins the title. And it's a nice little retirement award for Kane before he rides off into the sunset. Little did we know, he'd be main eventing shows 17 years later. That's wrestling. Then Albert gets the title. Might be the absolute lowest the championship has ever sunk. And I mean, look, like I think I'd rather the title go 7 years without being defended at WrestleMania than around the waist of a goddamn future hip-hop hippo. Hot potatoes to Test, to Edge, to Christian. It's rendered nearly meaningless by year's end. And there's just too many titles on the card to be of any interest, right? U.S., IC, European, Hardcore, Cruiserweight, Light Heavyweight. I mean, how is the title supposed to mean anything when every match on a given card can be a title match, right? And every title is changing hands like CM Punk in the women's locker room. I'm shocked, shocked they didn't bring in the WCW television title. Why not? Why didn't they bring over the Battle Bowl ring or the Monster Truck Championship or the Too Cold Scorpio Memorial Penis Award? Look, if you're going to go all in, go all in. The entire promotion is built around WWF versus WCW, and it felt like everything was part of the larger main event. So the mid-card was kind of a wasteland. Look, when Mick Foley comes out and is publicly criticizing you for having too many championships, maybe for once we should hear out the guy with 57 concussions. Rocco Martone. Love hearing from Rocco. 2001 was a year that I just let wash over me as it happened. It was so easy to be invested. There were so many awesome dudes bouncing up and down the card when needed. Undertaker in a hardcore title match in the middle of the card? Sure. Pop RVD and Benoit in the main event? Hell yeah. It all pretty much worked out great. This whole year was just so much fun. Pretty much everyone was over, and the quality of matches was so consistently good and unique. Thankfully, this is this before they decided to homogenize everyone's style in the WWF style we get today. Yeah. Speaking of Benoit, 2001 must be a tough year for people who can't watch Benoit matches, since he's incredible this year and is a standout in the mid-card all year, until he gets hurt, I guess. One great aspect of 2001 is that there's so many top guys that are all credible as world champ or challenger. Taker, Rock, Austin, Kane, Angle, Triple H, Y2J, Benoit, RVD. The world title scene was so unpredictable and really seemed like anyone had a chance to be the man. It is so odd that they pivot from this model over the next few years to one with no one being allowed to be on the same level as Cena, especially any babyfaces, leaving us with a company of mid-card nothings populating the card. Why do you think they strayed from this? Fuck, man, I don't know. It's, to me, Rocco, it's always insane to me that WWF has the history that it does, but doesn't learn from it or doesn't go back and see what worked and what didn't. I really, really don't understand. I don't. I can't even think of a reason why they would do it in this way, other than the fact that they maybe didn't have confidence in the people under him. But like it created a vacuum. Like when you think, when you look at late 2000s, like 2006, 2010, when you look at who it was in the mid card there, in 2006, you're like, wow, their main event scene is going to be incredible going forward. Then you get to 2011 and it's all the same guys that have been in the main event since 2005. And you're like, what happened to all the prospects? If they were a sports team, you'd fire the general manager for sure. Okay, back to Rocco. I had no problem with the Austin heel turn and really dug his psychotic, paranoid character. Since I know this gets shit on a bunch, is there a time in his career that you think wouldn't have been a better time to turn Austin heel? Maybe once he was retired from the ring doing the commissioner stuff. No, I think they nailed it. I'm with you. I love it. This was the time to do it. I just don't know if it was the time to do it at WrestleMania in Texas or with Vince. But I think the heel turn was... I like it. Rocco, I really love Jerkoff Taker as a character. He plays the prick biker almost as if it's merely an extension of his real life. Since motorcycles are the most obnoxious vehicle on the planet, it makes sense to be a conveyance of a dick heel. Motorcycles are like jerking off in public. You're the only one enjoying it and everyone else around you is fucking miserable. Kind of like Seth Rollins matches. Ah! So I'm rehearsing this play outside at a park because we're doing this outdoor production. And this motorcycle guy drives by blasting music. But like he's blasting. It couldn't have been more perfect. It's the climax of With or Without You from U2. Whoa! Whoa! It's like I couldn't imagine anything less tough than blasting the climax of U2 from a motorcycle than that. Back to Rocco. The Hardy Boys doing the Demolition Rumble spot is pure nonsense. Yes, it makes no sense and makes them both look like stupid as a result. Just like everyone else back in the day, I loved when Axe and Smash threw fists in 89. They were two old, crazy bondage bastards who just said, fuck it, we like to fight, let's fight. Two relatively small brothers having no concept of the power of numbers in a fight against 28 men tells me they're dumb shits who deserve to lose. This is proven by the fact that they knocked each other out like dummies and each went home a loser. Oh, hoser? Who? A loser. Please read that with the appropriate Canadian accent. Hey there, buddy. I'm not great at Canadian accents. I'll do my best. I spent most of 2001 partying like a maniac, so I didn't spend much time overanalyzing the invasion or the Austin heel turn, eh, boy? I just went along for the ride. This year was just so much of everything. So many titles, new matchups, wild gimmick matches, interesting characters and storylines, with most importantly of all, really good wrestling as the foundation. I also purchased my first DVD player and rewatched the shit out of those pay-per-views, so I spent much of the year falling asleep with the shitty menu screen music interloping into my dreams and messing with my circadian rhythm. I'm struggling to read this in a Canadian accent. I'm sorry. What is your history of wrestling media? Do you still have old TV off VHS tapes? Fuck yes, I have tons. I have boxes and boxes, which I started moving to VHSs, but some I just don't want to lose. I still have a lot of the original pay-per-view broadcasts. So I have like the original Royal Rumble. Anything I bought, I kept. And I still make it a point to buy every year. I buy the Royal Rumble, WrestleMania, and the SummerSlam. If anybody has an extra copy of Royal Rumble 1997, I lost it out of my cooler set. I missed that one. But that's what I kept. Also, what role do mind-altering substances play in your wrestling consumption, past and present? How do you find it enhances your experience? I'm going to be honest with you, Rocco. It never really played in. I was never a huge drinker. I mean, look, when I was younger, I drank. I drank to get drunk, like a lot of people do, right? But I never really did it during wrestling. I would have pitchers of beer or something, but I don't remember any binges. I remember lots of binges, but never with wrestling. And I've kind of been straight edge since 2009. So even now, it doesn't really play in at all. But, you know, watching Current, maybe it would help watching the Current. All right. Tag team. Thank you, Rocco. You're the best, as always. Tag team storyline, 19th out of 36. So I don't know how to balance this, right? Because on one hand, you have the greatness that is the trio of teams that carried 2000 so admirably. The Dudleys, the Hardys, Edge and Christian. They're all still awesome. On the other hand, you got Chronic. And how did Chronic not work? They were like the most over part of late WCW. Both guys look great, and like regardless of what you think of Bryan Adams, look, I'm a huge fan of his music, right? But Brian Clark should have been more than capable of carrying his team. Dude looked like a jacked up Mark Miro without any of the inadequacy issues. So I don't blame Chronic. I blame one of the most cancerous teams to ever lace up the boots, the Brothers of Destruction. Now look, I like both guys. And I think the team, as like a one or two off, it's a great addition to the company. But fuck, they're the dirt worst in 2001. They helped spearhead the only two bad months of the year when they feud with Austin and Triple H over the tag team titles. Then they go on a bit of a hiatus before storming back to destroy the career of DDP and possibly driving Canyon to an early grave. Then they have the Chronic debacle. The match on his own is an all-time bad, but it's just so unacceptable the way they're just dominated Chronic and left for dead. It really feels like a great example of like the wrestlers and maybe the company also taking a decision based on some kind of weird backstage rule that has a negative effect on the fans. And I'm not even saying Chronic were even that great. I didn't even really like them. But, you know, there's a chance to do something with them, so why not try, right? And it's not like the tag title scene doesn't have some crazy good highs either. The Dudleys are a highlight. The Hardys are a highlight. Edge and Christian are great while the team lasts this year. TLC at Mania is probably the greatest tag team title match of all time. So it's not like the year is devoid of any merit in this arena. It's just the bad is the same weight as the good. So it's the middle of the field. Speaking of great teams, Chad Campbell, JT, killing it on Wrestling Warzone every other Thursday on North South. On their latest episode, they talked the build to SummerSlam 1996. I can't wait to hear them tackle that show, as that's the show that really got me back into wrestling as a 16-year-old. Look, I'm sure there's going to be some Sid hate. Just as sure as they'll be raging my heart in my car as I hear it. But they tackle it all, the highs, the lows, the undeniable energy of a crazy period in the history of the business, every other Thursday on North-South Wrestling Warzone. Women's storyline, 27th out of 30. And this is where we're at the bottom. Now look, as a 21-year-old in 2001, that women's division was where it was at. There's a match that involves Trish, Lita, Tori, and Stacy removing their clothes. I mean, Christ, I don't even think I need to be 21 to appreciate that. I think that even the WWF would admit, even at the time they would admit, that WCW had them beat when it came to beautiful women. Tori Wilson and Stacy Keibler are among the most beautiful women in wrestling history. But boy, could they not wrestle. They would have been fine additions to the roster if they'd just been used as valets. But alas, we had to put them in matches, and the results were never good from an athletic standpoint. Honestly, in all the writing I've done for this project, so some like 230,000 words, this last paragraph that I just read for you is undoubtedly the hardest I have tried not to be a total horn dog, but also the hardest I've been. Trish is coming along as a wrestler. She's still not there yet. I think her best singles match is with Stephanie McMahon at No Way Out, but even then, it's more of a crazy spectacle than anything else, and the top score is 2.5 stars. For me, the best women's match of the year is the six-pack challenge at the Survivor Series, and it's only 2 3/4. This is countered by, like, the abysmal stuff at the bottom involving Trish and Jackie and the aforementioned goddesses from WCW. But then you have the China stuff, which is also super interesting because I love the idea of China entering the women's division. It's fresh and new. But instead of building credible challenges for her, they did this dumbass injury angle. I think there's real potential here with China. I mean, she came into the company about 2 decades too soon, like I mentioned earlier, because she was always in a really weird position, right? She was always super over and she could compete against some men, but not all men, right? Like, you couldn't really see her go up against, like, someone like The Undertaker. So she could have never really been the main attraction of the men's division. I mean, you saw it when she was Intercontinental Champion. The crowd turned on her as soon as guys like Jericho, Benoit, Guerrero got involved, right? In the women's division, she could have been the queen and a really great piece to build a credible division around. But she had no one to work with. Man, I wish she had the horsewomen around her, right? China versus Charlotte would have put a match like Trish Charlotte, like a legit great match, to shame. Let's hear from Justin Pratt, who I mentioned earlier, for a proud co-host of New Gen on a Mission. Pratt says, "O1 is the best and worst wrestling has to offer. Austin turning heel was great, and his character play along Vince and Angle provided some of the best TV ever. The matches and pay-per-views were all top tier, and the initial part of the invasion was fun. However, losing ECW and WCW was such a major blow to the landscape and allowed for cruise control programming going forward." Yeah, man, I hear you, brother. Yeah, that's the problem, right? Like, they'll never get over the lack of competition. You are bang on with that. Pratt continues, "It's also the first calendar year of me watching that Brett was no longer an active wrestler. Imagine losing the best wrestler of all time. Imagine that, Aaron." Here's the thing, dude. I don't have to imagine it. We lost the best wrestler of all time after WrestleMania 14. You know, we lost him for, God, 4 years, you know, until he came back and fought Triple H. So I feel your pain, man. I mean, we did lose the best wrestler of all time for 4 years. But holy shit, imagine being such a, like, number one, he could ride a bike. But number two, imagine being so full of courage that you come back and then have a whole second part of your career. It's a shame that the wrestling community is populated with such cowards. All right, Royal Rumble match, 13th out of 34. By the way, if you enjoy the Royal Rumble, oh, I love this little feud we've cultivated over Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels. It's my favorite part of the podcasting world now. By the way, if you like the Royal Rumble, check out Now Entering the Royal Rumble every other Monday on North South in tandem with this podcast. JT and I are breaking down the Royal Rumble careers of every single entrant who has entered in chronological order. We started with the great Bret Hart, who was the first entrant, and analyzed all of his Rumble performances, and we do that with everyone. This gives us a ranking of every Royal Rumble performance, as well as a cumulative ranking for all the Royal Rumble performers. It's a ton of fun to record. You'll never find a podcast doing as deep a dive into the Rumble careers of Coco Beware and Bushwhacker Luke. That being said, the prep is sometimes arduous, as I recently had to endure 31 minutes of Hercules at the 1991 Royal Rumble. That Rumble can fuck right off, all right? Now Entering the Royal Rumble every other Monday here on North South. So, 2001 Royal Rumble, 13th out of 34. So I think this is the Rumble that immediately comes to mind as like a potential upper tier one, like tippy top, until you watch it and see it's good enough to finish in like the top third, but it really falls a bit short of the greatest Rumbles of all time. That being said, it really is solid start to finish. There's quite a bit of dead weight, but the match is anchored really well by Kane and The Rock, so you hardly notice. The final three is maybe the best final three of all time. I wish I could say final four, but you know why we can't. And Kane's historic run, I think this is why this one's remembered really fondly. Plus, we get the shock of Haku, the musical stylings of the Honky Tonk Man, Scared Scotty Too Hottie, the Hall of Fame worthy performance of Drew Carey. My favorite part, though, is Bloody Austin winning his record-setting third Rumble. He makes this Rumble feel like a war that ends with him conquering a monster. A monster, Kane, who is unquestionably the MVP of the match. And it's really an amazing, impressive feat for a man his size to stay in there for like an hour. And he carries the beginning of the match. His 11 eliminations are fantastic. I especially like the moment where he gets fed up and just eliminates the whole hardcore division. It's like he really deserves to win a Royal Rumble, despite being the odds-on favorite in every single one that he's in. And I like the hardcore division spot. Like, I really do. I don't know why they felt the need to throw an actual garbage can into the ring filled with garbage. These guys are rolling around in garbage with cuts all over their bodies. That can't be good. Also, why? Why was Rikishi's music so low? Boom, boom,
boom, boom. I'm a bad man. I'm a bad man. You know, I'm a bad man.
Were they trying to make the audience struggle to see who was coming out? Well, who is that? What is that? Huh? As much as Kane was the MVP of this thing, the night did belong to Steve Austin. And I hope that his winning a third Rumble is a feat that's never repeated. Because the only active participants with two wins are Orton, John Cena, and Triple H. Oh, it's going to be Triple H, isn't it? And they even managed to catch some of that elusive Hogan Warrior standoff magic with Austin and The Rock. And I really like it, right? And it's really, it becomes their standoff, Austin and The Rock, becomes even more legendary with the inclusion of like crazed, bloody Austin. Watching live, I remember thinking Taz in his 10 seconds was a complete waste of him. But watching it again, I feel like they really missed the boat on William Regal. Because he gets a pretty solid reaction, but he's gone in 2 minutes. And it's a shame because he's so good at those little character moments that really add a lot of charm to the Rumble. I wish they would have given him Albert's time and given Albert the night off. Also, whoever designed Big Show's look for this night either measured completely wrong or felt that the world needed to see the world's largest midriff. During the match, too, I started thinking about the number of women that Drew Carey has probably slept with, and it made me really sad. Then I started about thinking about Drew Carey having sex, and I really couldn't sleep. Anyway, good, great Rumble, which is insanely memorable, still a ton of fun to watch, sets up Mania well, and pays off years of Kane never really doing anything at the event. Historical importance, 7th out of 36. I kind of feel like we need Freddie Blassie narrating this thing.
This is the end.
It's a really bad Freddie Blassie.
End of it.
There are years afterwards that have great in-ring action. But I think 2001 is the death of the wrestling that we loved as kids, teens, and young adults. The purchase of the competition took away any and all incentive for Vince McMahon to be creative in his endeavors. From this point on, it's all about making money. Not that it was never about making money. It's a business. I get it. But he made his money through creative endeavors instead of through business endeavors. It's no surprise that with WCW gone and no one nipping at their heels, we're treated to endless rematches and a complete aversion to any sort of risky booking. WCW brought out the best in Vince and WWF. 1997 to 2000 are probably the most creative the company has ever been. And it came out of a sense of desperation. Desperation they'll never feel again, right? Steven Van Cooten. In isolation, 2001 has a lot going for it. The matches, several including angles, and big moments are plentiful throughout the entire year. The invasion angle, poor as it may have been in the total execution, did lend relevance to the middle of the year, a time when the WWF has notoriously struggled to maintain buzz and momentum. Personally, 2001 is a lost year because I stopped paying attention to wrestling in 2000, but had a wild hair one Monday night to turn on Nitro. I was a strict WCW guy from 1996 to 2000, only to hear Tony say it was the final time Nitro would hit the air. I remember watching Sting and Flair for what I thought would be the final time, feeling lost. Never mind that Flair had to stuff his gut into a WCW Nitro shirt that was in turn stuffed into his tights. And never mind Sting had adopted the eccentric tendency to wrap tape all over his boots so he looked like an old-time socialite ready to take his erstwhile virgin bride to her first erudite party at the plantation. Jesus Christ, Stephen. Back to Steven. I tried to watch WWF, but the product didn't work for me, and I stayed away until 2004 when some WCW guys brought me back in. As for 2001, there's a whole lot of good, but the overreaching theme is one of squandered opportunities and disappointments. I can see why it ranks so high, yet I don't think the obvious shortfalls can be ignored either. Mick Foley's jokes about Stephanie McMahon leading ECW into the Alliance remains the most truthful echo of the year's footprint in WCW history. Yeah, I agree. I agree. And that, I mean, this project is ranking really from a perspective of quality, right? And historical importance is, and it's historically important, even though it's not necessarily good, right? But I can't disagree. And I think, Stephen, you have a really interesting perspective because the truth of all this is that the WCW fans went away and never came back, right? They didn't want what WWF was selling. And maybe you came back later due to the WCW guys being on top, but so many still didn't. And I think that's such an interesting perspective that gets lost in all of this is that after 2001, we lost an entire swath of fans. And I don't want to say that drove people back into the closet and being wrestling fans, but it definitely hurt wrestling's overall popularity. So yeah, thanks, Stephen. That's a really great take. This is also the last full real year of Steve Austin, who for my money is the last full-fledged megastar they've ever had. And I don't mean that as a slight on John Cena. I really do think Cena's awesome. But I think Hogan and Austin are on another level when it comes to wrestling. It may also be Steve Austin's best in-ring year, right? And he invents the what chant. That's historically important too. 2001 is also a huge year that it makes Rock a movie star. So in many ways, 2001 robs us of a guy nearly on the Hogan-Austin level. And 2001 Invasion storyline should have been one of the greatest in history, but in retrospect, it probably shouldn't have happened at all. Because we were talking about this earlier, right? Grunberg brought it up. In 2003, they would have had all the pieces to make a true invasion with guys they would have been hesitant to bury versus WWF guys. No one in the company cared about DDP and Booker T besides Kurt Angle, who hit us with that old saying, where there's DDP, there's Booker T. They would certainly be more hesitant to give a loss after loss to guys like Hogan, Hall, Nash, and Flair. And I'm not trying to get somber, but it really feels like this is a mega important year for all the wrong reasons. Finally, this is the year that started a new trend that still persists to this day. I've heard the narrative that the fans don't know what they want. They're fickle. They're stupid. It's the fans' fault for turning on somebody. And look, there's fans, I'm sure, that are that way. Hey, there's babies that like who are like, oh, they're not making Adam Page the champion? Well, I'm not watching. I'm sure that's a thing that happens, right? There are people that are like that, right? But 2001 is the year in which the company begins booking what they want instead of listening to the fans. It was the fans that chose Hulk Hogan. You forget about that. Without their cheers, he never would have risen so high. Fans chose the Ultimate Warrior, Randy Savage, Demolition, right? There was a time that if the fans got behind somebody, the company would push that person. And as a consequence, wrestling got hot, right? Imagine ignoring the fans in 1996, 1997. If that were today, if what was happening in 96, 97 were happening today, Steve Austin would remain a heel and would be treated to 5 years of blue chipper Rocky Maivia. In that scenario, Austin's never made, Rocky's never a megastar, and the company's probably out of business, right? That's the beauty of competition. It forces you to listen to your audience. As an artist myself, I understand the difference between projects that are for myself versus projects that are intended for people to like. If I choose not to listen, the last thing I'm going to go out and do is say shit like, well, the fans are fickle for not liking my choices. Or saying shit like, you know what? You know, this Thunderdome was good because in here, you can control the audience's sound, and it lets us tell the stories that we really want to tell. It's absurd. 2001 is the start of Vince McMahon's will trumping the audience's desires, and the company has never been the same as a consequence. Nowhere is this clearer than in the treatment of Rob Van Dam. In RVD, the company was handed a main event level wrestler. After his very first pay-per-view match with Jeff Hardy, he was ready. He was over with the fans, he was credible, and he was completely unique. In my eyes, too, this is retrospect, right? But he feels like the next evolution of the sport. See, because you can't base your next guy on the guy that came before. It's futile to find the next Hogan. You see, it failed when they tried to make it Luger, right? You needed to find the first Steve Austin. Look at what trying to create the next Rock did to John Cena's career. Rob Van Dam was incredible to watch. You didn't need him to cut promos. He got over by being one of the most athletically gifted guys they had. A few episodes ago, I think 1994, when I did 94, I brought up that WWF really made an effort to grow up with its audience. It gave us the superheroes in the 1980s, when we were kids, the cool guys in our early teens, and then the rebellion in our late teens, early adulthood. This, to me, seems like the next step in securing adults into the product. Because you can justify wrestling as an athletic attraction with a guy like Rob Van Dam. And that's kind of what you need to maintain interest in your 20s, right? In many ways, I mean, they would get there later with crazy athleticism in the ring. But it was with guys that the fans were less invested in. Guys that were always pushed as second behind the company's it guy. By the fall of 2001, Rob Van Dam was as over as anybody. Ever, really. I remember going to see the SmackDown before No Mercy 2001. The Van Dam chants were deafening throughout the night. Just as loud as the chants for Austin in 97-98, as loud as the Batista chants in late 2004. He was on the verge of becoming a top guy, but they didn't listen. And the next few years reaped the results of that deafness. The SummerSlam ranked 7th out of 34. And this is one of the sneakiest great SummerSlams the company's ever done. So much so that you forget about it. The opener is a lot of fun. Lance Storm and Edge get away from, once they get away from like stomping each other and actually start wrestling, it becomes quite good. Storm feels slower than usual in this match, almost like they asked him to slow down. I thought the match builds well, and by the time Christian's interfering, they're popping at all the near falls just like you're supposed to. On most other cards, the Dudley Boys and Test beating the APA and Spike will be the worst match. Sadly, later we have to humble some WCW guys, so that's not the case. I mean, this match isn't bad, the six-man or anything, 2.5 stars. But it really is a microcosm of the whole invasion problem, right? The only guys that are part of the Alliance that are allowed to win matches are the ones that defected from the WWF. Also, Test's real name is Andrew James Robert Patrick Martin. That's absurd. You can't just give him all the names. Pick one or two, you selfish fucks, okay? You can't have them all. Heyman also has the best line of the night here. He goes, "Devon, get the ambulance." Pop me a bit. X-Pac Tajiri is a ton of fun. Tajiri is so good with the microfacial expressions that everyone gets invested in everything he does. Also, at one point, Tajiri counters a pin attempt following the X-Factor with his legs and rolls up X-Pac with like his lower body. It's great. And the people just hate X-Pac. Is it the straggly hair? Is it the drug-addled eyes? Nah, it's the Bronco Buster, isn't it? Like, they just can't get behind a guy who hits guys with his dick. Look, Joey Ryan, right? Not a long shelf life. I also usually love the pairing of JR and Paul Heyman, but I feel they have a bit of an off night tonight. Heyman was at his sniveling best when he was sucking up to Austin and hating on JR, and that didn't really come through here. He had a couple funny lines, and there's JR's complete denial of Rocky's low blow to Booker. It was great, but it's a good night for them, not great. Jericho gets to fight Rhino in the infamous lifts match. It's fine. Stephanie's acting job as she tries to pump up Rhino is fucking brutal, right? All the bad actor tropes are there. Like walking nervously back and forth, pacing with no purpose, gestures that don't match the dialogue, and just plain awful forced line readings. She's utterly terrible. I think it'd be completely absurd today too, and I can't imagine anybody in today's WWE getting to kiss Stephanie as part of an angle. She's going to be like, "You're not going to kiss me. You're going to eat my pussy, you petulant child." Oh my God. How many times has Triple H been called a petulant child in bed? RVD versus Jeff Hardy. Damn good ladder match. They do tons of ladder spots you've never seen before. All the while stiffing the shit out of each other. And there's a huge botch at the end where RVD tries to kick Hardy while he swings on the wires. But fuck, look at the difficulty they're trying to pull off here. Fantastic action melded with RVD's star quality makes this a great watch to this day. Undertaker and Kane didn't need to murder DDP and Canyon. They just killed him for what feels like an eternity while both teams just stumble around while they punch and kick each other. Was this really the best they could do for DDP? A man who took a pay cut to come and work here? Good thing he's so positive. Then we get the aforementioned Angle and Austin match. Best moment on the card. Bloody Kurt Angle ruthlessly ankle-locking Steve Austin. Just a great picture. I mean, the way they booked Angle in this match made him for life. And just, he looks so badass in that crimson mask. And the main event of The Rock and Booker T is probably much better than most people remember it. They cut a real fast pace, solid match. And these guys probably just met for the first time like a couple weeks before. And Shane's involvement's even fun as he takes some good punishment, including a sick rock bottom on the floor. I mean, look, I think the Austin and Angle carries this far. The bad stuff on the show is maddening. It's solid top to bottom, right? And the biggest disappointment for me is the opener. I mean, it's good, but the guys involved, you think, would be better. Ultimately, though, very easy watch, super hot crowd to boot. Man, 2001 has some great pay-per-views. But there's got to be a worst show. And if you have a worst show of the year, you know what you want? You want Marcus and Tim telling you about it on Viewer's Choice. After every major big wrestling event, Marcus and Tim hit you up. They break down the card. And they stay up late to do it, too. They tell you what you should watch, what you should avoid, why Bret Hart is the greatest human to ever walk the earth. You know, tell that to Julie, right, guys? I bet she thinks he's a real great human. Anyway, two cool dudes talking wrestling. And, you know, like, if you want to have your opinion validated, you want to be outraged by a different opinion, Marcus and Tim are great, though, and both good guys. You know, one of my favorite things about doing this whole endeavor with anything we're doing North South is all the great the listeners have gotten to meet, but some of the other podcast guys too. And man, I you know, these guys are great. They're awesome guys. Their show is totally worth your time. I try to catch it every time it comes out. Viewer's choice after every single major wrestling event. All right, the worst show of 2001 is Backlash. Woo! Yo, you dealing with the X Factor? Dudley's and X Factor is actually pretty good, though. That's how good X-Pac is in 2001. He elevates a match with Justin Credible and Albert to watchable. Rhino and Raven for the hardcore title. Really fun. It's a shopping cart match. I think it's the second best match of the night. Then Regal and Jericho add a stipulation, which makes one of their matches worse. It's the Duchess of Queenberry match. But you didn't need to have an actual Duchess at ringside. Only in the WWF, right, can you be a Scottish woman who gets a job in corporate communications. You think you got this stable, sane job, right? Then they grab you. They stuff you in a white costume and force you to be an English noblewoman. I guess they gave her the Warrior Award in 2009 for shitting on her heritage and spitting in the face of guys like Robert the Bruce. Also, be careful around Vince because he's totally the type to throw you and your lover out the window. Angle and Benoit have a 2 3/4 submission 30-minute match. I don't know how that happened. Shane McMahon defeated The Big Show in a last man standing match. Which way did he go indeed? In the best match of the show, of the night anyway, Matt Hardy defeated Christian and Eddie Guerrero in a triple threat for the European title. And in the main event, Triple H and Austin versus the Brothers of Destruction. You know, it's not great. It's not the worst, not the best. It's subpar, though. So really, it's not even like the show's that bad, and Judgment Day the next month is similar. They just stand out as substantially below the greatness all around it. So the best match of the year is WrestleMania. But I actually had it tied points-wise with No Way Out. So let's talk about No Way Out, which tends to get forgotten, but it's easily an all-timer. So I have a ranking that I don't really talk about in this, but in my files, I have a master list of every pay-per-view ranked just by average star rating. You take all the matches, average star rating, you know, and that's what you do. If you take out takeovers, which aren't really a fair competition, I have No Way Out as the 16th best show on average the company has ever done. On average, I have it better than WrestleMania, right? Now, that doesn't mean it's a better show, and that's why when I'm doing the best show and worst show, I take a few factors. I don't just take star rating because it doesn't necessarily always make the best show. You could have, if every show in the card is 3 stars, that's going to be the best show of the year, right? But it doesn't talk about the peaks and valleys, right? That being said, just on average, 16th best is really good. It just doesn't have the huge moments and the tippy-top matches of a WrestleMania. But it also lacks all the bad No Way Out. 16th is actually really impressive too because really this is out of like 420 shows. That's a feat. Big Show wins the hardcore title in a fun clusterfuck. Then the crazy underrated match, 4 1/4 between Jericho, Benoit, Guerrero, and X-Pac for the IC title. Awesome action bell to bell. And X-Pac doesn't look out of place for 1 second. And I know I've kind of hinted at this throughout the podcast, but X-Pac in 2001 was a really sneaky little surprise for me. I was very happy every time he came out and relieved when he would come out. I was never annoyed to hear that X-Factor music. Stephanie and Trish, have the worst match on the card, 2.5 stars. And then Triple H and Austin tear the house down in their 3 Stages of Hell match. I'm going to give Triple H the credit here. This match was great. I was a bit disappointed on rewatch. I was thinking like 4 3/4, 5 for it. But I landed 4.5. Still an all-timer. I think the finish with both guys hitting each other with their weapons only for Triple H to fall on top is really great. Probably way harder to pull off than we give credit for. And I can even forgive the sledgehammer, sort of. Then Jerry Lawler fights his last match for almost a year. Dudley Boys and Edge and Christian carry the Brothers of Destruction to a good tables match. And then the main event of Rock and Angle is amazing. I just think it's such a great example of why The Rock was so good. So freaking smooth in there with Angle, plus the coming out of ass-kicking Angle. And professional wrestling is much better for it. I have that match at 4.5. Man, I could go on with great shows, right? 2001 is so good. Invasion is another awesome show. So is King of the Ring. Go watch 2001. It's worth it. All right, let's hear from Mike Eller. Mike Eller says, one of my favorite pay-per-views of all time, so I'm really happy it finished this high. The Invasion could have been booked much better, but this was still an awesome year of awesome shows. Royal Rumble, No Way Out, and WrestleMania X7 is about as perfect a start you can have to a year. in a lot of years, you can get away with No Way Out 2001 as your WrestleMania. Yeah, no kidding, eh? We're late in the show, so I won't go over all the ones that could be better, but that'd be a fun project. There is this April-June period that almost feels like a mirage because come July, the invasion is in full swing. There are some really awesome matches all throughout the summer and fall, and we get RVD coming into the promotion. The guy doesn't really say much, but he's a bigger star than maybe anyone in the promotion in 2001. I find it really fascinating about him and to a similar extent, Jeff Hardy. They aren't good in promos, but by just being themselves, the fans love them. I think that might be a bigger accomplishment than being super over guy who can cut a great promo. I agree. And they're living proof that this view of guys have to cut promos is flawed. There are guys that get over without cutting promos. And they become super popular. A guy they have on the roster right now that should be pushed to the top of the company is Ricochet. You never need to have a guy like that talk. He'll be over. Trust me. Did Kenny Omega in New Japan. Super over, never had to say a fucking word. Spoke a different language, right? Yeah. Great point, Mike. Okay, back to Mike. Something interesting about 2001 is how many different periods there are in the promotion. January, April feels like a carryover from 2000. April, June is this weird two-man power trip era that ultimately doesn't go anywhere because of the Triple H injury and the invasion. July, November is the invasion. And then December, we get Flair in the promotion and a shift towards Jericho as champion. One question I have for you, Aaron, is does any other year have this many shifts in the promotion as 2001 has? Thanks for the great content. And as always, I can't wait to listen to the show. Thank you, Mike. I really appreciate it. The only year I could think of that has a similar shift like that is 1992. Because you get the last vestiges of the Hulkamania era going into WrestleMania 8. Then you have, until Bret Hart wins the title, you have the Flair, Savage, really personal angle. But it's kind of the transition period out of Hulkamania. So it's like the transition period from the Hulkamania larger-than-life characters into the working guys. So you have the guys from the larger-than-life era who could really work carrying the promotion. And then you get Bret and Shawn and the last. So that's probably the closest, I think, that would come to it. That's what makes the most sense to me anyway. Let me hear from my partner, JT. 2001 is an unreal year on pay-per-view. If the two spring shows were better, it may be the perfect modern pay-per-view. Yeah, right. With every show delivering, the roster was loaded, whether the stories clicked or not, the talent was so good, and the crowds were so hot, everything felt important. Another benefit is JR and Heyman on commentary. Every show felt even more must-see because of the gravity they carried to them. I agree. Heyman was the first announcer since Ventura to make everything feel important with just his voice. It was an easy, because King just didn't have that gear of like making it important the way Ventura and Heyman did. It's so strange. Anyway. Heyman, it's back to JT. It was an easy year to throw in a rewatch, and the biggest shows of the year all nailed with the top-level iterations of each. Great, great year that often gets a bit overlooked due to the feelings of the invasion storyline. Yeah, that's the truest thing about this. All right, let's do five worst wrestlers, five best wrestlers, and get out of here. Five worst wrestlers. Number five, Albert. From make the big guy the Intercontinental Champion to fuck it, make the fat hairy guy dance. All within 7 months. Number four, Lita. It's not that she's awful, just everyone else is so good. She's fine against China and fine in the six-woman match. It's just the bullshit in Tori and Stacy that haunts her. Number three, Trish Stratus. Exactly the same thing, but replace China with Stephanie. Two, Ivory. Two awful matches with China and is slightly buoyed by the six-woman match at the Survivor Series. And the worst rest of the year, fuck, it sucks, but it's China. And as much as I talked her up, she stuck with Ivory for the better part of the year. But I think her match with Lita is substantially worse than the six-woman match, so she ends up finishing last. I hate it. Where's the fucking Undertaker? All right, five best wrestlers of the year. Number five, Rob Van Dam. Imagine how great this year is when the breakout guy only finishes fifth. The triple threat match at No Mercy is the high point, but I absolutely love the invasion match with Jeff Hardy as well. Then add a great match with Jericho and Unforgiven, a very good match with The Undertaker to close out the year. I think this is a really excellent showing. Plus, he had that magic, man. I feel that if we counted Raw and SmackDown, he would walk away with this award. Number four, Chris Jericho. He's involved in 8 matches that crack 4 stars. He's also in both the big tag matches with The Invasion and the Survivor Series. He's got the ladder match with Benoit, the series with The Rock, and don't forget the great triple threat with Benoit and Austin from King of the Ring. The Regal stuff is fine, and his worst outing is 2.5 stars against Rhino. But it's a hot feud, at least. Monster year for Y2J. Number 3, Kurt Angle. Man, match of the year with Austin. 3 of the top 5 matches. 8 4-star matches. Crazy King of the Ring, ring time and performance. His worst match against Triple H at the Rumble. No surprise there. I mean, just an undeniable for year for Kurt. And he's only number 3. Number 2, The Rock. This one is all about concentration of greatness. His worst match is the handicap match at Unforgiven against Booker and Shane, which I have at 3.5 stars. The next worst is Booker at SummerSlam, 3.75. Everything else is 4 or above. Plus, he nails one of the most memorable WrestleMania main events of all time. He's got a great underrated... We forget how great he is in the 2001 Royal Rumble because Kane's in there so long. But he's in there almost as long. Just a fantastic year from the great one. And the number one wrestler of 2001. Honestly, it can't be anybody else. It's Steve Austin. It can't be anybody else. And I was having a conversation with my buddy Robert Silva on Twitter. And he was saying that he believes Bret Hart's 1997 is the greatest in-ring year in company history. And I threw some other names back and forth. But when I was talking to him, I didn't throw Austin in here. And I think I was wrong to do that. I don't think it's just Steve Austin's best year. I think this year from Steve Austin on pay-per-view needs to be in conversation for the best year of any wrestler, period. Let's go through it quickly. He's great in the Royal Rumble match. Yeah, he comes in late, but he kills it when he's in there. And he wins, but he's super memorable. And the match is a really great, it's a great Rumble. Then he's got the 4.5 star classic with Triple H. Some people have that even higher. WrestleMania is a 4.75 match with The Rock. Many people have that at 5. Some people say it's the greatest main event, Mania main event of all time. Brother of the Destruction's a low point, but it's only 2.5. I like the Undertaker no DQ match from Judgment Day. I have it at 3.25. King of the Ring, triple threat with Benoit and Jericho. I have 4.25. Invasion Tag, which is the focal point of the company, and he's the focal point of the match, 4.5. SummerSlam with Angle, 5. Unforgiven with Angle, 4.25. Triple threat from No Mercy, 4.75. Survivor Series, winner take all. It's all based around him and The Rock, 4.25. I have Vengeance, 3.5 with Angle, 3 with Jericho. Yeah. I think this might be the greatest year of any performer of all time. I mean, you might have like a guy like Randy Savage in a year where he wrestles twice, have 2 great matches, but this is, he's on every show and every time he's out there, it's great. I'm going to give Ryan Gray the last word. Ryan Gray says, part of me is sad 2001 is not the first. Part of me is sad 2001 is in the top 3. Part of me is sad this podcast is almost over. Awesome year that ends up bumping, that ends up pumping the brakes pretty hard. However, the matches are consistently on the higher end. Rename the podcast the year that was nonstop and continue the pod somehow. Thanks in advance. Thanks, Ryan. I will continue doing a pod when this is done. I'll announce it later. Look, without a shadow of a doubt, 2001 was the most fun I had rewatching for this product, for this project. I think it's because my expectations were low, because I had the stench of the invasion and it colored my view the entire year. But what a ride. Like, just think, in this podcast, we're able to discuss WrestleMania, the Royal Rumble, SummerSlam, No Way Out, but I'm still left with shows I want to dissect further. Invasion is all-time great. So is King of the Ring. Not to mention the Survivor Series, which is great. There's just so much good here. This is when wrestlers were wrestlers, man. Think about that match with RVD, Angle, and Austin. I'm guessing no one told them a goddamn thing to do. The company just trusted them to go out and tear the house down. And they did. The Rock came back. And due to this, everyone else was elevated through the year. We have a great 4-man tournament in December with 4 credible challengers. This with Triple H on the shelf. And like I mentioned, it probably helped. So how high could this year have raised? Has it have gone up? Could it have finished number 1? 2001 finished 16 points out of the number 2 position. So for instance, let's say that instead of going to the Brothers of Destruction in the latter half of the year, if the tag title scene had focused only around the Hardys, Dudleys, Edge, and Christian, man, I think they could have made up those points. The beginning of the year was all-time great in the tag ranks. Furthermore, I think the breakup of Edge and Christian actually hurts the mid-card too, because they got into kind of these weird, nonsensical storylines, right, with that. So I think, you know, if they kept that tag title scene better, I think we might be looking at number 1. That, and if they'd run with China a little harder in 01, you know? So these are all small things, but as we're down to the nitty-gritty, as Gorilla would say, these things add up. Rewatching 2001 gets me excited. Even just rewatching one match and feeling how tangibly over everyone was in the match. Holy shit. If 2001 was the year that pro wrestling died and that sports entertainment took over, then 2001 was the best fucking funeral I have ever been to. Next time on The Year That Was. No more hints. We're down to the final two. I'm also going to be doing something different with your feedback this time, and that I'll take the feedback for both 1987 and 1997 at the same time. No spoilers till the day of. The Sevens reign supreme in this freaking project, and I can't wait to explore them. See you then.
My sacrifice.